Welcome to Radio Read-Along, a podcast for the whole family, featuring dramatic word-for-word readings of classic stories for all ages. In today's episode, Adam Andrews reads Part 1, Chapter 8 of The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. You can follow along in your own copy of the story, or sit back, relax, and let your mind's eye do the work. Chapter 8, The End of the World. I was once sitting on a summer day in a meadow in Kent, under the shadow of a little village church, with a rather curious companion with whom I had just been walking through the woods. He was one of a group of eccentrics I had come across in my wanderings, who had a new religion called Higher Thought, in which I had been so far initiated as to realize a general atmosphere of loftiness or height, and was hoping at some later and more esoteric stage to discover the beginnings of thought. My companion was the most amusing of them, for however he may have stood towards thought, he was at least very much their superior in experience, having travelled beyond the tropics while they were meditating in the suburbs, though he had been charged with excess in telling travellers' tales. In spite of anything said against him, I preferred him to his companions, and willingly went with him through the wood, where I could not but feel that his sunburnt face and fierce tufted eyebrows and pointed beard gave him something of the look of Pan. Then we sat down in the meadow and gazed idly at the treetops and the spire of the village church, while the warm afternoon began to mellow into early evening, and the song of a speck of a bird was faint far up in the sky, and no more than a whisper of breeze soothed rather than stirred the ancient orchards of the Garden of England. Then my companion said to me, "Do you know why the spire of that church goes up like that?" I expressed a respectable agnosticism, and he answered in an offhand way, "Oh, the same as the obelisks, the phallic worship of antiquity." Then I looked across at him suddenly as he lay there leering above his goat-like beard, and for the moment I thought he was not Pan, but the devil. No mortal words can express the immense, the insane incongruity and unnatural perversion of thought involved in saying such a thing at such a moment and in such a place. For one moment I was in the mood in which men burned witches. And then a sense of absurdity, equally enormous, seemed to open about me like a dawn. "Why, of course," I said, after a moment's reflection. "If it hadn't been for phallic worship, they would have built the spire pointing downwards and standing on its own apex." I could have sat in that field and laughed for an hour. My friend did not seem offended, for indeed he was never thin-skinned about his scientific discoveries. I had only met him by chance, and I never met him again, and I believe he is now dead. But though it has nothing to do with the argument, it may be worthwhile to mention the name of this adherent of higher thought, and interpreter of primitive religious origins, or at any rate, the name by which he was known. It was Louis de Rougemont. That insane image of the Kentish church standing on the point of its spire, as in some old rustic topsy-turvy tale, always comes back into my imagination when I hear these things said about pagan origins, and calls to my aid the laughter of the giants. Then I feel as genially and charitably to all other scientific investigators, higher critics, and authorities on ancient and modern religion, as I do to poor Louis de Rougemont. But the memory of that immense absurdity remains as a sort of measure and check by which to keep sane, not only on the subject of Christian churches, but also on the subject of heathen temples. Now, a great many people have talked about heathen origins as the distinguished traveler talked about Christian origins. Indeed, a great many modern heathens have been very hard on heathenism. And a great many modern humanitarians have been very hard on the real religion of humanity. They have represented it as being everywhere and from the first rooted only in these repulsive arcana, and carrying the character of something utterly shameless and anarchical. Now, I do not believe this for a moment. I should never dream of thinking about the whole worship of Apollo, what de Rougemont could think about the worship of Christ. I would never admit that there was such an atmosphere in a Greek city as that madman was able to smell in a Kentish village. On the contrary, it is the whole point, even of this final chapter upon the final decay of paganism, to insist once more that the worst sort of paganism had already been defeated by the best sort. It was the best sort of paganism that conquered the gold of Carthage. It was the best sort of paganism that wore the laurels of Rome. It was the best thing the world had yet seen, all things considered and on any large scale, that ruled from the wall of the Grampians to the garden of the Euphrates. It was the best that conquered. It was the best that ruled. And it was the best that began to decay. Unless this broad truth be grasped, the whole story is seen askew. Pessimism is not in being tired of evil, but in being tired of good. Despair does not lie in being weary of suffering, but in being weary of joy. It is when, for some reason or other, the good things in a society no longer work that the society begins to decline. When its food does not feed, when its cures do not cure, when its blessings refuse to bless. We might almost say that in a society without such good things, we should hardly have any test by which to register a decline. That is why some of the static commercial oligarchies, like Carthage, have rather an air in history of standing and staring like mummies, so dried up and swathed and embalmed that no man knows whether they are new or old. But Carthage, at any rate, was dead, and the worst assault ever made by the demons on mortal society had been defeated. But how much would it matter that the worst was dead if the best was dying? To begin with, it must be noted that the relation of Rome to Carthage was partially repeated and extended in her relation to nations more normal and more nearly akin to her than Carthage. I am not here concerned to controvert the merely political view that Roman statesmen acted unscrupulously towards Corinth or the Greek cities. But I am concerned to contradict the notion that there was nothing but a hypocritical excuse in the ordinary Roman dislike of Greek cities. I am not presenting these pagans as paladins of chivalry with a sentiment about nationalism never known until Christian times. But I am presenting them as men with the feelings of men. And those feelings were not a pretense. The truth is that one of the weaknesses in nature worship and mere mythology had already produced a perversion among the Greeks due to the worst sophistry, the sophistry of simplicity. Just as they became unnatural by worshipping nature, so they actually became unmanly by worshipping man. If Greece led her conqueror, she might have misled her conqueror. But these were things he did originally wish to conquer, ever in himself. It is true that in one sense there was less inhumanity even in Sodom and Gomorrah than in Tyre and Sidon. When we consider the war of the demons on the children, we cannot compare even Greek decadence to Punic devil worship. But it is not true that the sincere revulsion from either need be merely pharisaical. It is not true to human nature or to common sense. Let any lad who has had the luck to grow up sane and simple in his daydreams of love hear for the first time of the cult of Ganymede. He will not merely be shocked, but sickened. And that first impression, as has been said here so often about first impressions, will be right. Our cynical indifference is an illusion. It is the greatest of all illusions, the illusion of familiarity. It is right to conceive the more or less rustic virtues of the ruck of the original Romans as reacting against the very rumor of it with complete spontaneity and sincerity. It is right to regard them as reacting, even if in a lesser degree, exactly as they did against the cruelty of Carthage. because it was in a less degree they did not destroy Corinth as they destroyed Carthage. But if their attitude and action was rather destructive, in neither case need their indignation have been mere self-righteousness, covering mere selfishness. And if anybody insists that nothing could have operated in either case but reasons of state and commercial conspiracies, we can only tell him that there is something which he does not understand, something which possibly he will never understand, something which until he does understand, he will never understand the Latins. That something is called democracy. He's probably heard the word a good many times and even used it himself, but he has no notion of what it means. All through the revolutionary history of Rome, there was an incessant drive toward democracy. The state and the statesman could do nothing without a considerable backing of democracy, the sort of democracy that never has anything to do with diplomacy. It is precisely because of the presence of Roman democracy that we hear so much about Roman oligarchy. For instance, recent historians have tried to explain the valor and victory of Rome in terms of that detestable and detested usury which was practiced by some of the patricians, as if Curius had conquered the men of the Macedonian phalanx by lending them money, or the consul Nero had negotiated the victory of Metaurus at 5%. But we realize the usury of the patricians because of the perpetual revolt of the plebeians. The rule of the Punic merchant princes had the very soul of usury. But there was never a Punic mob that dared to call them usurers. Burdened, like all mortal things, with all mortal sin and weakness, the rise of Rome had really been the rise of normal, and especially of popular, things, and in nothing more than in the thoroughly normal and profoundly popular hatred of perversion. Now, among the Greeks, a perversion had become a convention. It is true that it had become so much of a convention, especially a literary convention, that it was sometimes conventionally copied by Roman literary men. But this is one of those complications that always arise out of conventions. It must not obscure our sense of the difference of tone in the two societies as a whole. It is true that Virgil would once in a way take over a theme of Theocritus, but nobody can get the impression that Virgil was particularly fond of that theme. The themes of Virgil were specially and notably the normal themes and nowhere more than in morals. Piety and patriotism and the honor of the countryside. And we may well pause upon the name of the poet as we pass into the autumn of antiquity. Upon his name, who was in so supreme a sense the very voice of autumn, of its maturity and its melancholy, of its fruits of fulfillment and its prospect of decay. Nobody who reads even a few lines of Virgil can doubt that he understood what moral sanity means to mankind. Nobody can doubt his feelings when the demons were driven in flight before the household gods. But there are two particular points about him and his work which are particularly important to the main thesis here. The first is that the whole of his great patriotic epic is in a very peculiar sense founded upon the fall of Troy. That is, upon an avowed pride in Troy, although she had fallen. In tracing to Trojans the foundation of his beloved race and republic, he began what may be called the great Trojan tradition, which runs through medieval and modern history. We have already seen the first hint of it in the pathos of Homer about Hector. But Virgil turned it not merely into a literature, but into a legend. And it was a legend of the almost divine dignity that belongs to the defeated. This was one of the traditions that did truly prepare the world for the coming of Christianity, and especially of Christian chivalry. This is what did help to sustain civilization through the incessant defeats of the Dark Ages and the barbarian wars, out of which what we call chivalry was born. It is the moral attitude of the man with his back to the wall, and it was the wall of Troy. All through medieval and modern times, this version of the virtues in the Homeric conflict can be traced in 100 ways, cooperating with all that was akin to it in Christian sentiment. Our own countrymen, and the men of other countries, love to claim, like Virgil, that their own nation was descended from the heroic Trojans. All sorts of people thought it the most superb sort of heraldry to claim to be descended from Hector. Nobody seems to have wanted to be descended from Achilles. The very fact that the Trojan name has become a Christian name and been scattered to the last limits of Christendom, to Ireland or the Gaelic Highlands, while the Greek name has remained relatively rare and pedantic, is a tribute to the same truth. Indeed, it involves a curiosity of language almost in the nature of a joke. The name has been turned into a verb, and the very phrase about hectoring, in the sense of swaggering, suggests the myriads of soldiers who have taken the fallen Trojan for a model. As a matter of fact, nobody in antiquity was less given to hectoring than Hector. But even the bully pretending to be a conqueror took his title from the conquered. That is why the popularization of the Trojan origin by Virgil has a vital relation to all those elements that have made men say that Virgil was almost a Christian. It is almost as if two great tools or toys of the same timbre, the divine and the human, had been in the hands of Providence, and the only thing comparable to the wooden cross of Calvary was the wooden horse of Troy. So, in some wild allegory, pious in purpose, if almost profane in form, the Holy Child might have fought the dragon with a wooden sword and a wooden horse. The other element in Virgil, which is essential to the argument, is the particular nature of his relation to mythology, or what may here in a special sense be called folklore, the faiths and fancies of the populace. Everybody knows that his poetry, at its most perfect, is less concerned with the pomposity of Olympus than with the noumena of natural and agricultural life. Everyone knows where Virgil looked for the causes of things. He speaks of finding them not so much in cosmic allegories of Uranus and Kronos, but rather in Pan and the sisterhood of the nymphs and Sylvanus, the old man of the forest. He is perhaps most himself in some passages of the Eclogues, in which he has perpetuated forever the great legend of Arcadia and the shepherds. Here again, it is easy enough to miss the point with petty criticism about all the things that happen to separate his literary convention from ours. There is nothing more artificial than the cry of artificiality as directed against the old pastoral poetry. We have entirely missed all that our fathers meant by looking at the externals of what they wrote. People have been so much amused with the mere fact that the China shepherdess was made of China that they have not even asked why she was made at all. They have been so content to consider the merry peasant as a figure in an opera that they have not asked even how he came to go to the opera or how he strayed onto the stage. In short, one have only to ask why there is a China shepherdess and not a China shopkeeper. Why were not mantelpieces adorned with figures of city merchants in elegant attitudes, of ironmasters wrought in iron, or gold speculators in gold? Why did the opera exhibit a merry peasant and not a merry politician? Why was there not a ballet of bankers pirouetting upon pointed toes? Because the ancient instinct and humor of humanity have always told them, under whatever conventions, that the conventions of complex cities were less really healthy and happy than the customs of the countryside. So it is with the eternity of the Eclogues. A modern poet did indeed write things called Fleet Street Eclogues, in which poets took the place of the shepherds. But nobody has yet written anything called Wall Street Eclogues, in which millionaires should take the place of the poets. And the reason is that there is a real, if only a recurrent, yearning for that sort of simplicity. And there is never that sort of yearning for that sort of complexity. The key to the mystery of the merry peasant, is that the peasant is often Mary. Those who do not believe it are simply those who do not know anything about him, and therefore do not know which are his times for merriment. Those who do not believe in the shepherd's feast or song are merely ignorant of the shepherd's calendar. The real shepherd is indeed very different from the ideal shepherd, but that is no reason for forgetting the reality at the root of the ideal. It needs a truth to make a tradition. It needs a tradition to make a convention. Pastoral poetry is certainly often a convention, especially in a social decline. It was in a social decline that Watteau shepherds and shepherdesses lounged about the gardens of Versailles. It was also in a social decline that shepherds and shepherdesses continued to pipe and dance through the most faded imitations of Virgil. But that is no reason for dismissing the dying paganism without ever understanding its life. It is no reason for forgetting that the very word pagan is the same as the word peasant. We may say that this art is only artificiality, but it is not a love of the artificial. On the contrary, it is in its very nature only the failure of nature worship, or the love of the natural. For the shepherds were dying because their gods were dying. Paganism lived upon poetry, that poetry already considered under the name of mythology. But everywhere, and especially in Italy, it had been a mythology and a poetry rooted in the countryside, and that rustic religion had been largely responsible for the rustic happiness. Only as the whole society grew in age and experience, there began to appear that weakness in all mythology already noted in the chapter under that name. This religion was not quite a religion. In other words, this religion was not quite a reality. It was the young world's riot with images and ideas, like a young man's riot with wine or lovemaking. It was not so much immoral as irresponsible. It had no foresight of the final test of time. Because it was creative to any extent, it was credulous to any extent. It belonged to the artistic side of man, yet even considered artistically, it had long become overloaded and entangled. The family trees sprung from the seat of Jupiter were a jungle rather than a forest. The claims of the gods and demigods seemed like things to be settled rather by a lawyer or a professional herald than by a poet. But it is needless to say that it was not only in the artistic sense that these things had grown more anarchic. There had appeared in more and more flagrant fashion that flower of evil that is really implicit in the very seed of nature worship, however natural it may seem. I have said that I do not believe that natural worship necessarily begins with this particular passion. I am not of the De Rougemont school of scientific folklore. I do not believe that mythology must begin with eroticism. But I do believe that mythology must end in it. I am quite certain that mythology did end in it. Moreover, not only did the poetry grow more immoral, but the immorality grew more indefensible. Greek vices, Oriental vices, hints of the old horrors of the Semitic demons began to fill the fancies of decaying Rome, swarming like flies on a dung heap. The psychology of it is really human enough to anyone who will try that experiment of seeing history from the inside. There comes an hour in the afternoon when the child is tired of pretending, when he is weary of being a robber or a Red Indian. It is then that he torments the cat. There comes a time in the routine of an ordered civilization when the man is tired at playing at mythology and pretending that a tree is a maiden or that the moon made love to a man. The effect of this staleness is the same everywhere. It is seen in all drug-taking and dram-drinking and every form of the tendency to increase the dose. Men seek stranger sins or more startling obscenities as stimulants to their jaded sense. They seek after mad Oriental religions for the same reason. They try to stab their nerves to life, if it were with the knives of the priests of Baal. They are walking in their sleep and try to wake themselves up with nightmares. At that stage, even of paganism, therefore, the peasant songs and dances sound fainter and fainter in the forest. For one thing, the peasant civilization was fading, or had already faded from the whole countryside. The empire at the end was organized more and more on that servile system which generally goes with the boast of organization. Indeed, it was almost as senile as the modern schemes for the organization of industry. It is proverbial that what would once have been a peasantry became a mere populace of the town, dependent for bread and circuses, which may again suggest to some a mob dependent upon doles and cinemas. In this, as in many other respects, the modern return to heathenism has been a return not even to the heathen youth, but rather to the heathen old age. But the causes of it were spiritual in both cases, and especially the spirit of paganism had departed with its familiar spirits. The heat had gone out of it with its household gods, who went along with the gods of the garden and the field and the forest. The old man of the forest was too old. He was already dying. It is said truly, in a sense, that Pan died because Christ was born. It is almost as true in another sense that men knew that Christ was born because Pan was already dead. A void was made by the vanishing of the whole mythology of mankind, which would have asphyxiated like a vacuum if it had not been filled with theology. But the point for the moment is that the mythology could not have lasted like a theology in any case. Theology is thought, whether we agree with it or not. Mythology was never thought, and nobody could really agree with it or disagree with it. It was a mere mood of glamour, and when the mood went, it could not be recovered. Men not only ceased to believe in the gods, but they realized that they had never believed in them. They had sung their praises, they had danced round their altars, they had played the flute, they had played the fool. So came the twilight upon Arcady, and the last notes of the pipe sound sadly from the beechen grove. In the great Virgilian poems there is already something of the sadness, but the loves and the household gods linger in lovely lines like that which Mr. Belloc took for a test of understanding. Incipe parve puer risu cognoscere matrem. But with them, as with us, the human family itself began to break down under servile organization and the herding of the towns. The urban mob became enlightened. That is, it lost the mental energy that could create myths. All round the circle of the Mediterranean cities, the people mourned for the loss of gods and were consoled with gladiators. And meanwhile, something similar was happening to that intellectual aristocracy of antiquity that had been walking about and talking at large ever since Socrates and Pythagoras. They began to betray to the world the fact that they were walking in a circle and saying the same thing over and over again. Philosophy began to be a joke. It also began to be a bore. That unnatural simplification of everything into one system or another, which we have noted as the fault of the philosopher, revealed at once its finality and its futility. Everything was virtue, or everything was happiness, or everything was fate, or everything was good, or everything was bad. Anyhow, everything was everything, and there was no more to be said, so they said it. Everywhere the sages had degenerated into sophists, that is, into hired rhetoricians or askers of riddles. It is one of the symptoms of this that the sage begins to turn not only into a sophist, but into a magician. A touch of Oriental occultism is very much appreciated in the best houses. As the philosopher is already a society entertainer, he may as well also be a conjurer. Many moderns have insisted on the smallness of that Mediterranean world and the wider horizons that might have awaited it with the discovery of the other continents. But this is an illusion, one of the many illusions of materialism. The limits that paganism had reached in Europe were the limits of human existence. At its best, it had only reached the same limits anywhere else. The Roman Stoics did not need any Chinese to teach them Stoicism. The Pythagoreans did not need any Hindus to teach them about recurrence, or the simple life, or the beauty of being a vegetarian. Insofar as they could get these things from the East, they had already got rather too much of them from the East. The syncretists were as convinced as theosophists that all religions are really the same. And how else could they have extended philosophy merely by extending geography? It can hardly be proposed that they should learn a pure religion from the Aztecs or sit at the feet of the Incas of Peru. All the rest of the world was a welter of barbarism. It is essential to recognize that the Roman Empire was recognized as the highest achievement of the human race, and also as the broadest. A dreadful secret seemed to be written, as in obscure hieroglyphics, across those mighty works of marble and stone, those colossal amphitheaters and aqueducts. Man could do no more. For it was not the message blazed on the Babylonian wall that one king was found wanting, or his one kingdom given to a stranger. It was no such good news as the news of invasion and conquest. There was nothing left that could conquer Rome, but there was also nothing left that could improve it. It was the strongest thing that was growing weak. It was the best thing that was going to the bad. It is necessary to insist again and again that many civilizations had met in one civilization of the Mediterranean Sea, that it was already universal with a stale and sterile universality. The peoples had pooled their resources, and still there was not enough. The empires had gone into partnership, and they were still bankrupt. No philosopher who was really philosophical could think anything except that in that central sea, the wave of the world had risen to its highest, seeming to touch the stars. But the wave was already stooping, for it was only the wave of the world. That mythology and that philosophy into which paganism has already been analyzed had thus both of them been drained, most literally, to the dregs. If with the multiplication of magic, the third department, which we have called the demons, was even increasingly active, it was never anything but destructive. There remains only the fourth element, or rather the first, that which had been in a sense forgotten because it was the first. I mean the primary and overpowering yet impalpable impression that the universe, after all, has one origin and one aim. And because it has an aim, it must have an author. What became of this great truth in the background of men's minds at this time, it is perhaps more difficult to determine. Some of the Stoics undoubtedly saw it more and more clearly as the clouds of mythology cleared and thinned away, and great men among them did much, even to the last, to lay the foundations of a concept of the moral unity of the world. The Jews still held their secret certainty of it jealously behind high fences of exclusiveness. Yet it is intensely characteristic of the society and the situation that some fashionable figures, especially fashionable ladies, actually embraced Judaism. But in the case of many others, I fancy there entered at this point a new negation. Atheism became really possible in that abnormal time. For atheism is abnormality. It is not merely the denial of a dogma. It is the reversal of a subconscious assumption in the soul, the sense that there is a meaning and a direction in the world it sees. Lucretius, the first evolutionist who endeavored to substitute evolution for God, had already dangled before men's eyes his dance of glittering atoms, by which he conceived cosmos as created by chaos. But it was not his strong poetry or his sad philosophy, as I fancy, that made it possible for men to entertain such a vision. It was something in the sense of impotence and despair with which men shook their fists vainly at the stars as they saw all the best work of humanity sinking slowly and helplessly into a swamp. They could easily believe that even creation itself was not a creation, but a perpetual fall, when they saw that the weightiest and worthiest of all human creations was falling by its own weight. They could fancy that all the stars were falling stars, and that the very pillars of their own solemn porticos were bowed under a sort of gradual deluge. To men in that mood, there was a reason for atheism that is in some sense reasonable. Mythology might fade, and philosophy might stiffen, but if behind these things there was a reality, surely that reality might have sustained things as they sank. There was no God. If there had been a God, surely this was the very moment when he would have moved and saved the world. The life of the great civilization went on with dreary industry and even with dreary festivity. It was the end of the world, and the worst of it was that it need never end. A convenient compromise had been made between all the multitudinous myths and religions of the empire, that each group should worship freely and merely give a sort of official flourish of thanks to the tolerant emperor by tossing a little incense to him under his official title of Devas. Naturally, there was no difficulty about that. Or rather, it was a long time before the world realized that there ever had been even a trivial difficulty anywhere. The members of some Eastern sect or secret society or other seemed to have made a scene somewhere. Nobody could imagine why. The incident occurred once or twice again and began to arouse irritation out of proportion to its insignificance. It was not exactly what these provincials said, though of course it sounded queer enough. They seemed to be saying that God was dead and that they themselves had seen him die. This might be one of the many manias produced by the despair of the age, only they did not seem particularly despairing. They seemed quite unnaturally joyful about it, and gave the reason that the death of God had allowed them to eat him and drink his blood. According to other accounts, God was not exactly dead after all. There trailed through the bewildered imagination some sort of fantastic procession of the funeral of God, at which the sun turned black, but which ended with the dead omnipotence breaking out of the tomb and rising again like the sun. But it was not the strange story to which anybody paid any particular attention. People in that world had seen queer religions enough to fill a madhouse. It was something in the tone of the madmen and their type of formation. They were a scratch company of barbarians and slaves and poor and unimportant people. But their formation was military. They moved together and were very absolute about who and what was really a part of their little system, and about what they said. However mildly, there was a ring like iron. Men used to many mythologies and moralities could make no analysis of the mystery, except the curious conjecture that they meant what they said. All attempts to make them see reason in the perfectly simple matter of the emperor's statue seemed to be spoken to deaf men. It was as if a new meteoric metal had fallen on the earth. It was a difference of substance to the touch. Those who touched their foundation fancied they had struck a rock. With a strange rapidity, like the changes of a dream, the proportions of things seemed to change in their presence. Before most men knew what had happened, these few men were palpably present. They were important enough to be ignored. People became suddenly silent about them and walked stiffly past them. We see a new scene in which the world has drawn its skirts away from these men and women, and they stand in the center of a great space like lepers. The scene changes again, and the great space where they stand is overhung on every side with a cloud of witnesses, interminable terraces full of faces, looking down towards them intently, for strange things are happening to them. New tortures have been invented for the madmen who have brought good news. That sad and weary society seems almost to find a new energy in establishing its first religious persecution. Nobody yet knows very clearly why that level world has thus lost its balance about the people in its midst. But they stand unnaturally still while the arena and the world seem to revolve round them. And there shone on them in that dark hour a light that has never been darkened. A white fire clinging to that group like an unearthly phosphorescence, blazing its track through the twilights of history, and confounding every effort to confound it with the mists of mythology and theory. That shaft of light or lightning by which the world itself has struck and isolated and crowned it, by which its own enemies have made it more illustrious and its own critics have made it more inexplicable, the halo of hatred around the Church of God. Radio Readalong is a production of the Center for Lit Podcast Network, featuring weekly episodes from the world's best stories. Like what you hear? Find an ever-expanding library of classic literature recordings inside the Pelican Society at pelicansociety.com. Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until next time, happy reading, everyone.